supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Pennsylvania Democratic U.S. Senator Bob Casey is encouraging more people to get out in the streets and march against the policies of newly elected President Donald Trump. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Casey spoke to a packed house last night about climate change at the Academy of Natural Sciences. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports.
Topping off a day of protests in Philadelphia that accompanied a visit by President Trump, Senator Casey told a gathering of more than 400 people in downtown Philadelphia to keep up the pressure. Casey spoke as part of a panel on climate change. He told the crowd he and his fellow Democrats are planning to filibuster, delaying a vote on Scott Pruitt, Trump's nominee to lead the Environmental Protection Agency. As Oklahoma Attorney General, Pruitt made a career out of suing the EPA.
We're going to use those hours to debate and go to the floor and make the case.
The nominee, Pruitt, also has strong ties to the oil and gas industry and has admitted to raising funds for an oil and gas super PAC. Casey said the recent activism, including the Women's March last weekend, had a big impact on his Senate colleagues.
I think that every one of us is seeing a lot of growth in terms of the people that are contacting us, the messages we're able to deliver. Stay involved, keep doing what you're doing, because it is beginning to aggregate and it's making a difference.
Although Pruitt does not completely deny human-caused climate change, he criticized federal air and water protections during his confirmation hearings. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Rebuild crumbling infrastructure. Two thumbs up. Build a wall on the border with Mexico. Not so much. Let's take the public pulse with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, Donald Trump's first full week in, and he says, yes, we are going to get started building a wall on the southern border. How does that resonate with the public?
Not at all, and that's very important. Not only Gallup, but a number of firms, and I just reviewed the data, have asked about building a wall, and every single poll I've looked at says majority do not favor building a wall. In some instances, a significant majority of Americans who say they don't favor it. Additionally, we put that in a list of promises that Trump had made, and for each one said, how important is it that he would follow through on this promise? And that was near the bottom, building the wall. So we don't have majority sentiment at all on the part of the public about the wall. That's interesting. If Trump discounts this information, he would have to discount a number of national polls that have shown that. Perhaps if he was being realistic, he would say, I know that majority of Americans don't favor building a wall, but for these reasons, I'm going to go ahead and do it anyhow.
Frank, let's bring in some good news. Apparently, Americans are feeling pretty good about their personal finances.
Oh, yes. If you look at the graph on Americans who say they're better off financially than they were a year ago, there's been a definite uptick. In fact, we're as high now as we have seen it going back 10 years to before the recession back in 2017. About half of Americans say they are better off than they were a year ago. You have to go back to the dot-com boom to find numbers that were even bigger than that when we had, up in the middle to higher 50% who said they were better off. So we clearly have pulled out of the funk, so to speak, of the recession. And like a lot of other indicators, this personal finance optimism has been increasing steadily. And as I mentioned, as high as it's been in 10 years at this very point in time.
And so with that, do most folks think that the economy will continue to improve?
They do. I mean, there's no question about it. We saw the Dow cresting 20,000, of course, this week. And when we ask Americans about their confidence in the U.S. economy, we find a complete flip from last year. Right now, we have Americans fairly strongly saying the economy is getting better on a relative basis, 56% of Americans. And last year at this time, January of 2016, a year ago, we had a flip. 62% said it was getting worse. So in just 12 months, we've had a total flip. Americans are now very optimistic about the economy. And I have to say, a lot of this started when Donald Trump was elected president of the U.S.
And so in turn, are Americans feeling better about job creation?
They indeed are. And we have looked at job creation by state. And what's interesting here, Dave, is that we've had quite a few flips in where you want to be for jobs. Just a few years ago, we talked about Wyoming and we talked about North Dakota, these oil booming states where jobs were through the roof. They couldn't get enough employees. People were living in trailers and what have you. Guess what? A total flip. Wyoming's now dead last in terms of its residents saying their companies are hiring rather than firing. Wyoming's not where you want to go right now in terms of jobs. North Dakota's now fallen into the bottom 10. All this is relating to the oil and gas industry. Now, it may be recovering in 2017, but throughout 2016, when we gather these data, those states previously riding high were riding very low. What's at the top? Nevada, Utah, Michigan, formerly in the doldrums. Now Michigan's up there as the third highest state in the union in terms of people saying, hey, companies are hiring up here in Michigan, auto industry related. Georgia, South Carolina, Minnesota, these are the other states where people say, my company is hiring.
Safe to say our region is less volatile?
Yeah, right in the middle. All three states in our area have neither been at the top nor the bottom of the list since we've been doing this for over 10 years. Pennsylvania is 30th out of the 50 states. Let me be specific with you. 41% of Pennsylvania workers said their companies are hiring. 12% said their companies are firing. Delaware, 32nd in the nation, and New Jersey is 34th. So all three states in our area about the same, but slightly below average.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. In 2013, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention was called into Wilmington to study gun violence among youth from a public health perspective. Now, a coalition of community leaders is offering what they hope will be some solutions to the problem. WHYY's Nichelle Polston reports.
In 2015, the final CDC report said social services needed to do more with the city's youth violence that was considered a public health concern. The coalition of state and Wilmington officials then created a blueprint to tackle gun violence committed by juveniles. This report suggests a new approach to addressing violence, says Rita Landgraf, secretary of the Delaware Department of Health and Social Services.
Up until this point, you know, we've been reacting. We've been reacting to the trauma that we have seen in our city.
There are nearly 20,000 children living in the city, and more than 60% of them have experienced trauma. It hits too close to home, says Wilmington Council President Hanifa Shabazz.
The decision to reach out to the CDC to investigate the epidemic of homicides in Wilmington was both personal and part advocacy driven. My family has experienced firsthand the pain and suffering caused by violence.
Delaware leaders have created about 6 recommendations to prevent youth violence, especially in crime-ridden areas. One step is to integrate a number of social services that Mayor Mike Przycki says he strongly supports.
I look at this as an opportunity to reimagine the solutions to dealing with the problems that afflict our neighborhoods.
According to officials, Wilmington may be used as a model throughout the state and eventually neighboring cities after the CDC's research on youth violence from the public health perspective. From the Delaware desk, Nichelle Polston, WHYY News.
Philadelphia's international bike race is down, but apparently not out. WHYY's Tom McDonald explains.
Mayor Jim Kenney's office announced the race had been canceled for 2017 for lack of finding a $1 million sponsor for the cycling event. Councilman Curtis Jones says that ensures taxpayers won't be on the hook for the cost of the race.
They're more conservative with an eye towards how do we get these dollars, how do we procure them, because they do not want to, at the end of the day, like in 2 different occasions, wind up holding the financial bag.
Canceling the event doesn't sit well with Philadelphia Congressman Bob Brady, who says the bike race brings international attention to Philadelphia.
It's great for the neighborhoods. It's great for the for Manayunk and that area. And they come back in the center city again. It's great. It's just great for the city. It puts us back on the world stage again.
Brady says he wants to resurrect the event for this year, not 2018. Race director Robin Morton says it's not so easy to bring back an event that's been canceled.
They're international teams. They need to schedule their racing programs. They can't have a weekend without racing.
Jane Lipton, executive director of the Manayunk Development Corporation, says security costs have skyrocketed since the Boston Marathon bombing. While the race brings people into the neighborhood, especially to watch riders scale the hill known as the Manayunk Wall, she says security was just too expensive. Councilman Jones says he's not giving up, and if the race remains dead, he wants other events for the neighborhoods that have benefited from it.
If we cannot salvage that bike race to provide other festivals and block parties and things that might be able to generate some of the revenue.
Jones adds he doesn't think the city should necessarily be the entity that runs the event. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
Pennsylvania is one of seven states commemorating January 30th as the Fred Korematsu Day of Civil Liberties and the Constitution, honoring the legacy of this World War II-era Japanese-American civil rights activist. Also on Monday, the Historical Society of Pennsylvania will host a related discussion featuring Kermit Roosevelt, a professor of constitutional law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School and author of Allegiance, a legal thriller examining U.S. national security policies during World War II. Professor, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Professor, this is a discussion in part around President Franklin Roosevelt's Executive Order Number 9066, and let's get it out there. You're a very distant relative of FDR and a closer relative of Teddy Roosevelt.
I am, yeah. I'm Teddy's great-great-grandson, and Teddy and Franklin were second cousins, so that makes me, I'm not even exactly sure, but some sort of distant relative of Franklin, yeah.
Did that DNA connection in part pique your curiosity about this issue?
It did a bit. You know, I think I felt a bit of a connection to the events, and I felt a bit of a connection to the U.S. government.
Let's first go back to sentiment around Asians and Japanese specifically in the years and decades leading up to December 7th, 1941.
Well, there was a lot of anti-Asian prejudice. So, you know, the Japanese immigrants were by law not allowed to become U.S. citizens. The children of the Japanese immigrants were, because of our 14th Amendment, guaranteed birthright citizenship. So those are the Japanese Americans. They're American citizens. But the whole community was treated, you know, really sort of as if they were more Japanese than Americans.
Though shortly after World War II started, public sentiment was in favor of Japanese Americans maintaining their heritage and existence in the Western states.
Yes. So, you know, immediately after the attack, the Japanese American community responded as patriotic Americans would. You know, they were outraged. They were thinking of themselves as Americans. In a lot of communities, the immediate reaction was also to view them as Americans, but the government tended not to see it that way. So Japanese Americans tried to enlist for the armed forces. They were turned away, in some cases, on the grounds that they were enemy aliens, which, of course, they weren't.
So in the short months after Pearl Harbor, what were the pressures brought to bear on President Roosevelt to ultimately issue this executive order? And let's describe 9066.
Well, President Roosevelt was getting pressure from the military. And, you know, there were people in the military who sincerely but erroneously believed that the Japanese Americans posed a threat of disloyalty.
And so what did Executive Order 9066 mandate?
Executive Order 9066 told the general in charge of the Western Defense Command, who was a general named John DeWitt, that he had the authority to exclude anyone he deemed necessary from the West Coast states. It became clear that there was going to be this exclusion of the Japanese Americans from the West Coast, and some of them tried to leave on their own. Some of them were turned back at the state line. So it wasn't really possible for any substantial number of them to leave the West Coast. And then, ultimately, actually, the Army commander, General John DeWitt, issued a freeze order saying, you're not allowed to leave except pursuant to my orders, and then he ordered them into camps.
So this was subsequent to the original intent of the president's order mandating merely an exclusion zone.
Yes. So one of the things that I think people don't understand about this whole episode is they think the government decided it was necessary for reasons of national security to confine Japanese Americans in camp. That's not really true. The only reason they ended up in camps was because their fellow Americans wouldn't take them in.
Ultimately, how many Japanese Americans ended up in internment camps?
It's about 120,000 people, all in all.
Among the dissenters was one Fred Korematsu. Let's bring him and his efforts into the mix.
Well, Fred Korematsu came to this in an interesting way. He wanted to stay on the West Coast because he wanted to stay with his fiancée, who, interestingly enough, was Italian-American. So he wanted to resist this order. He was prosecuted. The civilian judge actually said, you know, you're defying this order, but you don't seem like a threat to me. I'm going to release you back into Oakland, where you want to be. And then the military came in. The military police took him away from the federal court at gunpoint. He was sent to a camp, but he continued to fight this order all the way up to the Supreme Court.
And their finding?
fewer people than should know about Fred Korematsu at all. But even the people who do know about Korematsu probably think that the Supreme Court said detention in camps is okay. What it said was exclusion is okay. It didn't say in the Korematsu case that it was okay to detain them in camps. And then, in fact, when the Supreme Court was forced to confront that issue, it said detention is not okay unless you can prove disloyalty.
Ultimately, Korematsu's case was reopened and in 1983, I believe, formally overturned.
So the Supreme Court's decision doesn't get overturned. But lawyers who were working on the redress movement find out that actually the government engaged in serious misconduct during Korematsu's case. The government presented information to the Supreme Court that it really knew was false. The government withheld information from the Supreme Court. Lots of people in the government knew that there was no national security justification for removing the Japanese Americans, you know, much less detaining them in camps. And the government took an aggressive litigating position with the Supreme Court and set out to win that case rather than setting out to be candid and open with the Supreme Court.
Professor Roosevelt, thanks for offering perspective on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you.
Kermit Roosevelt, professor of constitutional law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School and author of Allegiance, a book examining U.S. national security policy during World War II. You can hear how Fred Korematsu's case affected future Supreme Court rulings in the expanded version of our conversation on NewsWorks.org. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Our news director is Eugene Son. John Mussoni is Assistant Vice President for News Operations. At the controls this week, Diana Martinez and Adam Staniszewski. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.